Turn with me to start in Hebrews chapter 11. We're going to introduce really the next two characters in a contrast, but we're only going to get to one tonight and then get to another one as we go through. But Hebrews 11, 32 through 34 gives us in the, we call it like the hall of faith, these great men and women of the faith. And Hebrews 11, 32 through 34, it says to us, "What more shall I say then? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens." We're going to look at two contrasting judges. This week we'll do Gideon, and then we will get to Samson next. And so we're gonna look at these two judges, and they make a great image, because really Gideon's the strong judge who started weak. Samson was the weak judge who started strong. And so you can kind of look at the stories from opposite perspectives. When we think of judges, though, our mind turns to a very American picture of a judge, like Rick at the courtroom, right? So he goes to the courtroom and there's the judge. And the judge sits up there, and depending on what court case you're in, you know, the more formal they look. If you watch the Supreme Court justices, the nine people, when they walk out in their pageantry and they sit down in their little pre-assigned desks, and it's very formal, and you watch the judges, and people give information, and another person gives information, and they got to go back and forth, and then the judges kind of recuse themselves, and they come back, and they give you an answer. Well, that's kind of how we think of judges. But when we think of judges, Old Testament judges, these were deliverers. These were kind of like hands-on military. They were leaders who took the people of Israel out to free themselves from the bondage of the opposition or the armies of the people around them or whatever was happening. And so when we think of judges in the Old Testament context, they were very military-type-minded people. In the timeline of Israel, when we leave Moses and Joshua, but before we get to King Saul, that's the time frame of the judges. Okay, so that's the point of Israel's history that these people fall into. And so when we go from Joshua, the book of Joshua, to the book of Judges, the book of Joshua ends with the Israelites who have just entered the promised land, and they pledge to wholeheartedly honor the Lord. Joshua 24:24. The Lord our God we will serve, and his voice we will obey. Sounds a familiar phrase that Israel will say over and over again and then abandon. Years earlier, Moses had instructed the people that if they served the Lord faithfully, they would be blessed. But if they rebelled against God, then God would obviously punish them. Moses in Deuteronomy 30, verses 15 to 18 says it this way: "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil, and then I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commandments, his statutes, and his judgments, that you may live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you possess. But if your heart turns away so that you do not hear, and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you will surely perish. You shall not prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to go in and possess." So the people initially heeded Moses' warning. According to Judges 2:7, the generation of Joshua served the Lord faithfully. But shortly after they died off, another generation arose that committed the ultimate evil in God's sight, and that was worshiping idols. They turned from worshiping the true God to worshiping other gods. Now, why did they begin to worship other gods? Because they didn't do what God told them to do at the very beginning of going into the promised land. He said, when you go into the promised land, you remove all of the inhabitants. You take all of those idol-worshipping pagans and you get rid of them. And the nation of Israel, they got in and they got a good portion of the land. They're like, it's close enough. Right? It's like when you're raking leaves in your backyard. And you're kind of like, that's close enough. You understand what the nation of Israel did. They didn't obey God at the beginning, and then their disobedience is going to cause problems later on. It's going to come back to haunt them. The book of Judges records centuries of Israel's repeated spiritual failure and God's continual grace towards his rebellious people. Everything in their history keeps repeating themselves. During four centuries, God appointed at least 14 judges at different times and in different regions, and their appointment was not by inheritance. It was not by popular vote or conquest or man-made selection. They weren't even elected to a specific age or term. They were divinely random choices that God placed in a sovereign plan for a specific purpose. Some great names. If you ever want some odd names to throw out there, and like if you're playing trivia, names of judges are great ones. Let's see how good I can do my pronunciation. Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, always my favorite, easy name to pronounce. She was accompanied by Barak, Gideon, Tola, Jer, Jephthah, Ibzan, hope I got his name right, sorry if I got it wrong, Elon, Abdon, Samson, Eli, and Samuel. These judges that God raised up, God is once again demonstrating his faithfulness to the people of Israel. Now, when we go through that list of judges, kind of in my mind, the most unlikely of all of that list is Gideon. Because when we find Gideon at the very beginning in Judges 6, Gideon is not a man to be reckoned with because he's important. Go with me to Judges 6. Let's look at Gideon's life. It used to be the game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And if you didn't know the answer to the question, you could poll the audience. And then the audience would be like, oh, it's A or it's B. And then you could kind of see if you want to go with the audience. If you polled the nation of Israel and they said, pick us a judge to lead you out of this, no one would have picked Gideon. Not even Gideon. Okay? There was no one who was looking at Gideon going, I'm with that guy. When we find ourselves in Joshua, when we find ourselves looking through in Judges 6, looking through the life of Gideon, we find some really funny things. When we first find him, go to verse 11 with me. It says in verse 11, now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while the son of Gideon threshed wheat in the wine press in order to hide it from the Midianites. Okay, threshing wheat is you throw it up in the air and you let the breeze blow away the wasted part, and then the good part lays down and you have it. Okay, he is threshing wheat indoors. One, this is not going to work real well. But two, he's doing this indoor because he's afraid that the Midianites are going to see him and they're going to come steal his food. Okay? Because this is what's been happening for years. Okay? They've come and stole his food. Verse 12. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. I imagine the angel saying this and Gideon looking around. Like, who? Who? Talk to me? Right? Because he says, mighty man of valor, to a guy who's doing an outdoor job indoors because he's afraid of somebody else. This does not seem like your mighty man of valor. Right? This is not your, like, oh, yeah, I'm with that guy kind of thing. So all of a sudden, we start off by the angel talking to Gideon. And to be honest, he's not telling Gideon who Gideon is. He's telling Gideon who Gideon will be if he trusts God. This is not who the person Gideon is. It's going to be the person that God is going to do through Gideon. As he's sitting there and he's hiding and he's doing all of these things, he says to the angel, verse 13, Oh, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, then why has this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us, and he's delivered us into the hand of the Midianites. Here is a great question that Gideon poses to the angel. If God's with me, why am I in a wine press threshing wheat? I do want to pause because there's a theological thing that we do just like Gideon did. And that is, we look at the past, we avoid our own failures, and then we ask God why he's not blessing me. All right, so here's the nation of Israel. They didn't do what God told them to do. They didn't remove the Midianites from the land of Canaan, the land of promise. Now the Midianites are a thorn in their flesh, and they say to God, why aren't you blessing us? Now, we're more spiritual than the nation of Israel, so we would never do this. We would never sin against God and then get grumpy when he doesn't bless us. Right? I mean, no, really, we do this all the time. Well, God says, don't do this. And we go, I'm going to do it anyway. And then God chastens us. And we go, why are you chastening us? Why are you not blessing me? I'll be honest. This is one of the things that always crack me up when people say, I don't know why God's not blessing America. And I go, I do. Like, it's not hard. Turn on the TV. Why would God bless people who don't bless him? Why would God bless people who disobey so many clear teachings of God? Right? And we stand like Gideon and we say, where are all the miracles? I mean, we've heard about these things. Where are they? And the Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours. Once again, ironic statement. And you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you? So he said to him, oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. Okay, I remember when Paul was like, I'm a Hebrew of the Hebrews. I'm like top of the food chain, but I still needed Christ. Gideon's bloodline's a little not as amazing. He's like, hey, I'm in like the weakest tribe, and then I'm like the runt of my own family. Right? Okay, so not only do I not have any political clout because, I mean, I'm in the wrong family, but even in my family's side of the whole nation of Israel, my family has no clout. So I have no clout in my immediate family, and my immediate family has no clout in my tribe, and my tribe has no clout in the rest of Israel. You might have got your flow chart wrong here, God, right? You picked the wrong person. This is exactly how Moses started. God said to Moses, I'm going to send you. Moses, I can't do this. I can't speak. Verse 16. The Lord said to him, surely I will be with you. You shall defeat the Midianites as one man. So Gideon has now been told he's going to be successful. He's talking to God here. And he's not quite convinced. So we begin the process of what I will call Gideon's unbelief needing to be reassured. And so, verse 17, then he said to him, if I have now found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me. So he's going to go through a process of asking God to verify himself. It's one of those odd things, but we kind of look at Gideon, and I do this. I look at Gideon and go, man, this guy doesn't have any faith, right? He's talking to God, and he's still not convinced. And there's all these little tests that he's going to give God. And then God is going to end up giving all of these tests back to Gideon, right? Because he's going to keep shrinking the size of the army. But here's Gideon, and we kind of look at him and go, man, Gideon, why don't you have any faith? You're talking to God. But then if we just stop and kind of put ourselves into Gideon's shoes, you're in a wine press, threshing wheat. You're not a bold, confident risk taker. This is not who you are. You're not a natural born leader. Right? If he took one of those like personality tests, Gideon's not a type A take charge guy. So he says to God, I want you to do something. Verse 18, do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out my offering and set it before you. And he said, I will wait until you come back. So Gideon went in and prepared a young goat. Have you ever been in line or at a restaurant and you think your food took long? Gideon tells God to sit and wait. He's going to go make him lunch. How does he make lunch? He goes, prepares a young goat. Anybody have an idea how long this takes? Right? Anybody like self-butchered anything for fun? Right? Like, I love to hunt, and so I butcher my own deer. This is not a quick process. So he butchers this goat, then he's got to cook it. Verse 19, unleavened bread from an ephah of flour, the meat he put in a basket, put the broth in a pot, he brought them out to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. Lunch comes back a couple hours later. The angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth. And he did so. The angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and he touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Then fire rose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. And the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. And I love verse 22. Now Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. Okay, so now that the fire has come out of the rock, he's like, oh, light bulb is turned on. He's got it. And you kind of go, this is it. Gideon's now going to be energized and he's going to go do what God wanted him to do. Verse 22 says, alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. The Lord said to him, peace be with you, do not fear, you shall not die. So Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and he called it the Lord is peace to this day. Now it came to pass, verse 35, that night the Lord said to him, you take your father's young bull, the second bull is 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the wooden image that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of this rock in the proper arrangement, and take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image which you shall cut down. So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants, and did as the Lord had said to him, but because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. So God says to Gideon, take down the altar of Baal, put up the right altar, offer me a sacrifice. Okay, what did God tell Gideon that he was going to do? He told Gideon he was going to lead the nation of Israel out of oppression from the Midianites. The first step that God told Gideon to do was to tell the nation of Israel to worship the right God. Okay, we've got to put the story in the right order. Because a lot of times we want God to bless us, but we don't want to deal with our sin. So this is what God tells Gideon. Listen, if you want to see blessing, you got to worship the right God. Go tear down the altar your dad built to Baal. Put up the right altar. Take your dad's bull. Offer it as a sacrifice to the right God. Because if you want to defeat the Midianites, you've got to worship me first. Do you understand? This is how God wants us to work in our lives. We often want God to give us the blessing, but we don't want to remove the sin from our life. You don't get that. You don't get God's blessing, and he doesn't kind of just gloss over sin. Okay, so the nation of Israel needs to worship the right God. And so God tells Gideon, go do this. And Gideon, who's seen the angel of the Lord face to face, is full of confidence. And nope, he's not. He goes out at night because he's afraid of his dad. This guy who's going to lead the nation of Israel out of captivity, out of the oppression of the Midianites, doesn't have enough confidence to tell his dad what he's going to do. This is not an overwhelmingly confident start to the story of Gideon. But Gideon goes, and he does what he's supposed to. In verse 28, the men wake up in the morning, and what happened? Someone messed with our altar. Verse 29, so they said, I wonder who has done this thing. When they inquired and asked, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. Then the men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son that he may die, because he has torn down the altar of Baal, because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it. So Joash said to all who stood up against him, would you plead for Baal? Would you save him? Let the one who would plead for him be put to death by mourning. If he's a god, Let him plead for himself because his altar's been torn down. Okay, so the argument is, hey, listen, if he's a real God, he'll take care of himself. Okay? Then all the Midianites, verse 33, and the Amalekites, the people of the east, gathered together, and they crossed over and camped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew the trumpet, and the Abzurites gathered behind him. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who also gathered behind him. And he sent messengers to Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. So Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. Let me read that one more time. If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. Look, I'm going to put a fleece on the wool, a wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only and it is dry on the ground, no, it's going to work. So he says to God, if you really said what you said, I know you said it, but just to double check, I'm going to put a rag out on the ground, and I want the rag to be wet, ground dry. So he wakes up, and it is as it is. And Gideon, being the super confident man that he is, says, you know what, maybe that was just a fluke of nature. So let's flip that, ground wet, fleece dry, right? Verse 40, and God did so that night, and it was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on the ground. So Gideon has asked God for a sign at the threshing floor. He's taken the prophet of the altar of Baal down at night. He's gathered some men behind him, and just to make sure, he's given the test of the fleece twice. And here goes Gideon. Verse 1, chapter 7. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him, rose early and encamped beside the well of Herod. So the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands. Lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me. Okay, so God says to Gideon, all right, you've tested me. Now I'm going to test you. You have too many people. Too many people. If you go into battle with this amount of people, you're going to take credit. The Israelites are going to say, we did this. So that can't happen. So I want you to, verse 3, to tell people if they're afraid, if they're fearful, they can go home. Now just stop and think about this for a second. Who isn't afraid? Gideon, their leader, was threshing wheat indoors because they're afraid of the Midianites. Okay, so he says this to them. And I love the tally. I don't know who counted them as they left. But the text tells us 22,000 people left. Okay, so it says 10,000 remain. So two-thirds of his makeshift army left. Can you understand the vote of confidence that Gideon's got going on right now? Gideon says to the people, listen, if you're afraid, you can go home. And two out of every three people stand up and walk away. Okay, we're going home. Now, if you're the people who stood behind, you're probably like, I want to go with them. I wasn't afraid before, but now there's only 10,000 of us. This doesn't look nearly as impressive as it did before. So the Lord said to Gideon, verse 4, that there is still too many of them. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same will go with you. And if I say to them, they're not going with you, they won't go with you. So he brought down the people to the water. The Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps from the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set apart by themselves. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. And the number of those who lap, putting their hand in their mouth, was 300 men. And all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. Okay, so if you got down and just sucked the water from the lake, instead of putting it in your hand and kind of like bringing it up to your mouth, 300 people made it easy. They went down to the water and sucked it up. 300 people put it up to their mouth, and everyone else, 9,700 of them, got it the other way. The Lord said to Gideon, and I don't know how Gideon's mind going, but I'll pretend like I'm Gideon. You see 300 in one group and 9,700 in the other, and you go, Lord, pick that group, the 9,700, like those people. And God goes, nope, the other ones. And you can almost see Gideon go, really? Okay, you guys can go home. And if you're the 300 people, how awesome do you feel right now? Right? You started this process with basically 32,000 people. You're like, we got it. Now you look around and you're like, there's 300 of us. That's not a whole lot of people, by the way. Like, there are 280 seats in the auditorium. So if every one of these seats were filled, you would be Gideon's army. Now, I don't know about you, but I would not be super impressed by that size army. You would not be like, this is it. This is going to be the plan. Now, the story gets even better because the plan for the battle is you are going to take into battle a trumpet and a lantern under a pot. Now, I've heard some pretty bad trumpet playing in my life. My parents did when I learned to play trumpet in like fourth grade. My parents went through an excruciating time period of life where they had to listen to me practice that thing for an hour every day. But I didn't kill anyone with it. It was close, but no one died. And so Gideon says, hey, listen, bring out the orchestra, some lanterns, grab some pottery. We're going to battle. And if you're the 300 people, you're like, what did I just sign up for? Like, you sent home basically everybody, and then you hand me a musical instrument, and you're like, go get them. Right? So God tells the plan, and as you go through the plan, we find ourselves, verse 13, God giving another sign to Gideon. When Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, I've had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian, came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed. Then his companion answered him and said, I got to stop first before you get to. There's a loaf of bread and it takes out a tent. Now, this dream is weird first, but the dream really kind of carries no significance. If you're Gideon and you hear this dream, you kind of go, a loaf of bread knocked over a tent. Odd, weird. The guy should probably change some of the diet he's eating right before he goes to sleep. But it's just weird. Then in verse 14, his companion answered him and says, I know what your dream meant. This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand, God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. Now, if you're Gideon and you're sitting there, there's a couple of things that you know. First, this guy doesn't know who you are. Remember, least family, least tribe, not impressive, right? It's not like there's been a bunch of articles written in the, you know, the Bethlehem Gazette about the amazing things Gideon has done. But God sovereignly has this companion say to the other guy, this dream was Gideon, the son of Joash. Verse 15, so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand. He divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet in every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. Watch, and when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp and say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. Just as they posted the watch, they blew the trumpets, broke the pitchers that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers. They held the torches in their left hands and the trumpet in their right hands for blowing. And they cried, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And every man stood in his place all around the camp. And the whole army ran and cried out and fled. When 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp. And the army fled to Beth Acadia and towards Zerah, and as far as the border of Abel, Meholah, and Tabith. And the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and all of Manasseh and pursued the Midianites. All of a sudden, here's this Gideon guy. He said, here's the plan. Blow the trumpets, break the pitchers, lights. God has the armies attack themselves. So all the nation of Israel is left to do is to chase them down. the remaining ones. We talk about the power of what God's doing through the nation of Israel through Gideon. But I want to end this evening and just talk about the faith that it took for Gideon's men to stand there and blow their trumpet and shatter their little piece of pottery. You got 300 men. Divide them up into three companies. So now you're in a group of 100. If the Midianites know who you are, know how many of them they are, they just overrun you. The other thing about battle, when you're a small group like that, you don't want to give away your position. You don't want to tell people where you are. What was the plan of Gideon? Light a torch, put it on a thing, and when we break it, everyone will know exactly where you are. So these men, you're walking to your position, and you're like, hey, sound like a good plan? So we go up to the edge of the enemy. We blow our trumpets so they know we're here. Like, hey, we're here at your enemy camp. Then we break our pitchers so they can see exactly where we are. They can see our faces in the light now. And then we yell, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. Does that phrase ring ironic to anybody else? There are no swords. They didn't get a sword. They got a trumpet and a torch and a pitcher. And they walk out by faith because of what Gideon knew about God. See, as Gideon the judge, he struggled understanding God's purpose for his life. He understood believing that this is really what God wanted him to do. But as God constantly, I'll say humors, but as God graciously let Gideon have weak faith, as God addressed that inside of who he is, all of a sudden, Gideon's faith becomes strong. And as Gideon's faith becomes strong, the people who follow Gideon's faith becomes strong. See, the story of Gideon is not the greatness of Gideon. The story of Gideon was that God chose this person, this guy, who was threshing wheat indoors, and he said, I'm going to use you to do amazing things. If you read missionary biographies, or you like character sketches, and you get to read through some of these great men and wisdom of the faith or things that have happened, almost all of them have one thing in common. They didn't think they were going to do great things for God. They didn't wake up one morning and they're like, man, I'm amazing. God is going to do something amazing through me. Almost all of them had to be pushed into, listen, do this, do this. It's fascinating to me to read stories of what seems like common people that God did amazing things through. And he's doing these amazing things through them. And why is he doing it? He's doing it because God wants to work for his own glory. God glorified Gideon the way he was supposed to. It's impressive for us. It's encouraging for us to realize that God will do this through us. He will do this because he alone is worthy of this glory. So think of the story of Gideon. We're going to contrast this with the story of Samson. If there was ever a story that started like, oh, this guy's going to be the judge, it would have been the story of Samson. But unlike the story of Gideon, where his faith increases through the story, Samson goes the other way. So we'll contrast the story of Gideon with the story of Samson next time.